Kia ora. This program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
Nau mai, haere mai. I'm John McDonald. Kia ora, and welcome into the Community Drive Hut Zone on Thursday, the 23rd of October. The Hut Zone is Wellington Access Radio's weekly look into the stories, people, history, poems and music that make the Hutt Valley community. Tonight, we meet the recipient of this year's Upper Hutt Piano Trust Scholarship, Amelia Lynn, ahead of her concert at Whirinaki Expressions on Sunday, the 26th of October. Our history segment looks at Upper Hutt's industrial growth in the motor manufacturing sector, courtesy of Upper Hutt Libraries. Tonight, it's about accidents and unions. And there's a Catherine Mansfield short story reading from her first published book, In a German Pension, The Baron. So let's start things off with our weekly poetry reading.
I'm Arlene Osk. I'm reading a poem called The Nest by Barbara Calnon. This came third in the 2022 Upper Hutt Libraries Poetry Competition, Adults category. The Nest. Arrive. Welcome. Family. Best. Food. Nourishing. Cooking. Tasty zest. Encouraging. Engaging. Amusing. Liveliest. Warmth. Snuggling. Comforting. Rest. Family, gathering, nurturing, home, best nest.
That was Trentham's Arlene Croft reading The Nest by Barbara Calnon. Time for our short story reading of the week. Another story from Catherine Mansfield's book, In a German Pension. Let's first hear the introduction her husband, John Middleton Murray, wrote in the book. In a German Pension was Catherine Mansfield's first book. It was published in 1911 when she was 21. The sketches and stories which compose it first appeared in the New Age during the two previous years. In a German Pension met with a considerable success on its appearance. It ran quickly into three editions. Then the publisher defaulted and was made bankrupt. The stereotype plates disappeared into the void, and with them all hope of royalties. Catherine Mansfield was not very disappointed. She quickly became indifferent to the book, then hostile. It represented for her a phase of youthful bitterness and crude cynicism, which she desired to disown forever. How alien to herself she considered it may be judged from the fact that at the outbreak of the war with Germany, when one or two publishers made her attractive offers for the right of republishing it, she steadily refused, although she badly needed money. At that moment, in the general detestation of things German, there is no doubt that the book would have achieved a very great popular success. At that moment, and indeed at most other times in her life, £500 would have been untold wealth to Catherine Mansfield. But nothing would induce her to make £500 by republishing In a German Pension, partly because she thought the book itself unworthy, but even more, as I remember, because she thought it unworthy of herself to take advantage of the odium into which Germany had fallen. There followed a long period during which Catherine Mansfield wrote much and published nothing. Not until the publication of Prelude in 1917 was the silence broken. When Bliss appeared in 1920 and achieved immediate success, she was once more urged to allow In a German Pension to be reissued. I passed this request on to her. This was her reply. I cannot have the German Pension reprinted under any circumstances. It is far too immature, and I don't even acknowledge it today. I mean, I don't hold by it. I can't go foisting that kind of stuff on the public. It's not good enough. but if you'll send me the note that refers to it, I will reply and offer a new book by May 1. But I could not for a moment entertain republishing The Pension. It's positively juvenile, and besides that, it's not what I mean. It's a lie. Oh no, never. To which I replied that an author, having once deliberately printed a book, could not disown it in that way, and that the reason why she felt so acutely about her first book was that she had waited too long before publishing her second. In fact, it was not merely a good book, but a truly remarkable one to have written at 19. Moreover, by refusing to republish it, she could not annihilate it. In a German pension was irrevocably in existence. She replied, "Very well, Isabel, about The Pension, but I must write an introduction saying it is early, early work, or just that it was written between certain years, because, you know, Betsy, it's nothing to be proud of. If you didn't advise me, I should drop it overboard. But of course, I'll do the other thing, and it certainly airs one's name. But why isn't it better? It makes me simply hang my head. I'll have to forge ahead and get another decent one written, that's all." But Catherine Mansfield never did write that introduction. John Middleton Murray.
Baron by Catherine Mansfield. Narrated by Harry Dobby. "Who is he?" I said. "And why does he always sit alone with his back to us too?" "Ah," whispered Frau Oberreigensrat. "He is a baron." She looked at me very solemnly, and yet with the slightest possible contempt, a fancy not recognising that at first glance expression. "But poor soul, he cannot help it," I said. "Surely that unfortunate fact ought not to debar him from the pleasures of intellectual intercourse." If it had not been for her fork, I think she would have crossed herself. "Surely you cannot understand. He is one of the first barons." More than a little unnerved, she turned and spoke to the Frau Doctor on her left. "My omelette is empty, empty," she protested. "And this is the third I have tried." I looked at the first of the barons. He was eating salad, taking a whole lettuce leaf on his fork and absorbing it slowly, rabbit-wise, a fascinating process to watch. Small and slight, with scanty black hair and beard and yellow-toned complexion, he invariably wore black serge clothes, a rough linen shirt, black sandals, and the largest black-rimmed spectacles I had ever seen. The Herr Oberlehrer, who sat opposite me, smiled benignantly.
"It must be very interesting for you, gnädige Frau, to be able to watch. Of course, this is a very fine house. There was a lady from the Spanish court here in the summer. She had a liver. We often spoke together." I looked gratified and humble. "Now, in England, in your boarding house, one does not find the first class, as in Germany."
"No, indeed," I replied, still hypnotized by the Baron, who looked like a little yellow silkworm.
"The Baron comes every year," went on the Herr Oberlehrer, "for his nerves. He has never spoken to any of the guests.
Yet." A smile crossed his face. I seemed to see his visions of some splendid upheaval of that silence, a dazzling exchange of courtesies in a dim future, a splendid sacrifice of a newspaper to this exalted one, a Dankeschön to be handed down to future generations. At that moment the postman, looking like a German army officer, came in with the mail. He threw my letters into my milk pudding, and then turned to a waitress and whispered,
She retired hastily. The manager of the pension came in with a little tray. A picture postcard was deposited on it, and reverently bowing his head, the manager of the pension carried it to the Baron. Myself, I felt disappointed there was not a salute of 25 guns. At the end of the meal, we were served with coffee. I noticed the Baron took 3 lumps of sugar, putting 2 in his cup, and wrapping up the 3rd in a corner of his pocket handkerchief. He was always the first to enter the dining room, and the last to leave, and in a vacant chair beside him he placed a little black leather bag. In the afternoon, leaning from my window, I saw him pass down the street, walking tremulously and carrying the bag. Each time he passed a lamppost he shrank a little, as though expecting it to strike him, or maybe the sense of plebeian contamination. I wondered where he was going, and why he carried the bag. Never had I seen him at the casino, or the bath establishment. He looked forlorn, his feet slippered in his sandals. I found myself pitying the Baron. That evening, a party of us were gathered in the salon discussing the day's cur with feverish animation. The Frau Obereigungsrat sat by me knitting a shawl for her youngest of 9 daughters, who was in that very interesting, frail condition. "But it's bound to be quite satisfactory," she said to me. "The dear married a banker, the desire of her life." There must have been 8 or 10 of us gathered together, we who were married exchanging confidences as to the underclothing and particular characteristics of our husbands, the unmarried discussing the overclothing and peculiar fascinations of possible ones. "I knit them myself," I heard Frau Lehrer cry, "of thick grey wool. He wears 1 a month, with 2 soft collars." "And then," whispered Fräulein Lisa, "he said to me, 'Indeed you please me. I shall perhaps write to your mother.'" Small wonder that we were a little violently excited, a little expostulatory. Suddenly, the door opened and admitted the Baron, followed by a complete and death-like silence. He came in slowly, hesitated, took up a toothpick from a dish on the top of the piano, and went out again. When the door was closed, we raised a triumphant cry. It was the first time he had ever been known to enter the salon. Who could tell what the future held? Days lengthened into weeks. Still we were together. And still the solitary little figure, head bowed as though under the weight of the spectacles, haunted me. He entered with the black bag. He retired with the black bag. And that was all. At last, the manager of the pension told us the Baron was leaving the next day. "Oh," I thought, "surely he cannot drift into obscurity, be lost without 1 word. Surely he will honour the Frau Obereigungsrat or the Frau Ferdlet Nanswurtable once before he goes." In the evening of that day, it rained heavily. I went to the post office, and as I stood on the steps, umbrella-less, hesitating before plunging into the slushy road, a little hesitating voice seemed to come from under my elbow. I looked down. It was the first of the Barons, with the black bag and an umbrella. Was I mad? Was I sane? He was asking me to share the latter. But I was exceedingly nice, a trifle diffident, appropriately reverential. Together we walked through the mud and slush. Now, there is something peculiarly intimate in sharing an umbrella. It is apt to put one on the same footing as brushing a man's coat for him, a little daring, naive. I longed to know why he sat alone, why he carried the bag, what he did all day. But he himself volunteered some information. "I fear," he said, "that my luggage will be damp. Invariably I carry it with me in this bag. One requires so little. The servant, sir, untrustworthy." "A wise idea," I answered. And then, "Why have you denied us the pleasure?" "I sit alone that I may eat more," said the Baron, peering into the dusk. "My stomach requires a great deal of food. I order double portions and eat them in peace. which sounded finely baronial. "And what do you do all day?"
"I imbibe nourishment in my room," he replied, in a voice that closed the conversation and almost repented of the umbrella.
When we arrived at the pension, there was very nearly an open riot. I ran halfway up the stairs and thanked the Baron audibly from the landing. He distinctly replied, "Not at all." It was very friendly of the Herr Oberlehrer to have sent me a bouquet that evening, and the Frau Oberreigensrat asked me for my pattern of a baby's bonnet. Next day, the Baron was gone. Sic transit gloria German Mundi.
I'm Joe MacDonald, and you're in the Hot Zone on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM, and that was The Baron by Catherine Mansfield, read by Harry Dobby. Thanks to Bookstream Audiobooks for making that reading available on their YouTube channel. Next is history from Upper Hutt City Libraries on the rise and fall of the city's manufacturing industries. Tales from the Trades, from the 2024 Upper Hutt City of Industry Exhibition. Incidents and Accidents at General Motors, featuring oral history extracts from Harry Ross and Margaret Donaldson.
Big clock in the factory, 10 times bigger than that, and if the lane stopped, that clock would start. And that's what they call downtime. And that's very serious because that's cost the company a lot of money. But sometimes the guys would do it themselves, break the line.
That's what would hurt.
Yeah. They'd put a gumboot in or something in that.
What would be the purpose of that?
Well, to stop the line, stop you working. Imagine you're going like that. You thought, shit, I could stop that. So you get a break. Because there wasn't a lot of breaks.
No.
And that was hard, heavy work. We had an attempted murder outside, and a guy tried to kill another guy with a hammer out the back and put him in a compactor out the back. But the guy got out of it and struggled his way back into the factory, and he was found. Remember one time we had a black dip. It's where the car comes along, bloop, and Ford had a water base. We had an awful product, black. You can just, and there used to be waste line of the car would be done with this. It's rust protection. Then it would go through an oven and be baked. I was coming through one day, this guy Mark Rennish, and he was with me, and I heard plop. This guy dropped into it. Yeah. So he pulled him out. He was like an eel. It was Black Morris. Never came back. But the thing the company didn't like was an ambulance at the factory. It wasn't a good look.
He was working in the factory, and the panels for the cars before they were put together, the edges were very sharp because it was a fine metal. And he was standing on a pipe for some reason, and it rolled. And of course he went down with a bump and sliced his arm, the muscle in his arm, like a sausage cut down its length it was. But that was when I first started, and so the other nurse that had been there for quite some time did a very good job of putting a bandage around it. A man one day who got a hog ring, and he's working in the upholstery department, and they used to, that's how they fastened the vinyl or whatever it was onto the seats. And it was a thing that happened occasionally. People would get themselves in the hog ring.
Oh.
But we always sent them back to the factory because they had a hog ring remover there.
Unions, Industrial Action in Upper Hutt, featuring oral history extracts from Colin Harris, Harry Ross, Tony Dee and Raywin Heath.
And I can remember as a kid, Dad coming home and Mum said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "We're out on strike." And she burst into tears and said, "I've got 6 kids. How do we feed them?" And he said, "We'll look after them."
A lot of guys struggled, hey, and Mike organised a butcher to give us meat. There was a lot of other unions from other places that helped, you know, to supply food for them.
You couldn't work at Dunlop's without being in the Rubber Workers Union. The best thing that ever happened, and the fact that we earned big money over there, but we had to strike to get some of the money that we got over there. Now, people outside Dunlop's used to say, "Those blooming Dunlop workers, they're always on strike. Look at the money they're earning. What more do they want?" And everyone was sort of pointing the finger at us. But, hey, if you work from 8 to 4 every day, is a lot different than working shift work over there.
Mm-hmm. There was lots of little issues.
Yeah.
But it's mostly over money. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's what annoyed us. We would go out, fight, and get it sometimes. Then the engineers would just get it automatically. So there was a lot of friction there. That was me lying on the ground in front of the bus.
So what was the bus trying to do?
It was bringing engineers who were not in our union from the railway station to work at the plant. And we said, no way. It was all pretty heated these days. And the head of personnel has passed away now, Tom Cunningham. I remember him saying, "Put 25 on your bumper, Jack." He didn't want the bus to stop, but the bus did stop. So that's the thing. Then we were all in court for weeks.
Wow.
Yeah, they took us to court, but we won our case.
That was the only animosity between Trent and Nabaha. Because the coach workers down there were quite vocal and militant.
Yeah.
They'd go out and strike most years.
Yeah, okay.
But we didn't.
Right.
We weren't part of their issues.
Yeah. Different kind of work.
Well, they used to pick at us.
We had a union man, Fred Thorne, who used to... I was a bit anti-unions, I guess, and he used to come out in a taxi from Wellington, and he would go round probably a couple of hundred women while the taxi waited outside. And that used to really annoy me. I wouldn't join, and he threatened to blacklist the factory, and we wouldn't get any deliveries of fabric, and so the boss pleaded with me to join the union.
I had to work for the union.
Yeah.
Didn't last.
Yeah, yeah.
Worst job I've ever had in my life. I can live with the corruption. A lot of them tend to forget they're using workers' money to do what should be for the worker.
Yeah.
They have their moments, they do some good stuff, and it's like everybody.
Mm-hmm.
They make blunders, don't they?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's no power now, have they?
No.
You wouldn't lie in front of a bus today.
Try to see it my way. Only time will tell if I am right or I am wrong. While you see it your way, there's a chance that we might fall apart before too long. We can work it out. We can work it out.
I'm Jim McDonald, and you're in the Hut Zone on Wellington Access Radio 106.1 FM, and that was part 2 of Upper Hutt City Library's Trade History Series. The final episode airs next Thursday. The video version of the story is always available by Googling Upper Hutt Recollect and Tales from the Trades. It was produced by the library in 2024. On Sunday, the Steinway Grand Piano gets a play at Whirinaki Expressions in Upper Hutt. So I thought it was timely to talk to the winner of the Upper Hutt Piano Trust Scholarship, Amelia Lynn.
My name is Amelia Lynn, and the Piano Trust prize that I won this year is by people from the Expressions in Upper Hutt. And then they're very generous to give me this scholarship so that I could play in their concert hall upstairs.
How did you first become aware of the Upper Hutt County Trust and its scholarship? How did you first find out about it?
It wasn't a scholarship that I had to apply for. It was more like a prize that just got given to me. But throughout the past couple of years during my study at New Zealand School of Music, every year our teacher would organize these lunchtime concert series with the expressions in Upper Hutt. So then they would have some piano students in every trimester to go there and then perform some pieces. Mm-hmm. So I think from there they would look at who they... of course, I think they enjoyed all of our playings, but they pick from the people that they've listened to, choose a winner, and then give the prize to.
Right. So you've obviously played in it at the Expression Sorenaki Center on the Upper Hutt Steinway piano. What's it like as a piano and as a concert hall to perform in?
I actually haven't played in the concert hall yet. For the lunchtime series, we usually play in the auditorium that they have a smaller, I think it was a Yamaha grand piano.
Okay.
But I've been to two of the past recipients' concerts, and it looks like a really lovely venue, and they've got this gorgeous Steinway D piano, and it's just, yeah, it's like a dream to me to be able to play there.
Can you talk us through the pieces that are on the program for the 26th of October, and also just explain on each piece, why did you select it for this concert?
Yeah, sure. So I would start my program with two Bach Prelude and Fugues, both from Book 1, E major and then E minor. I thought they would make a good pair since, you know, they're in the same key, just a major and a minor following each other. And the major one, it has this really singing quality to it. It's like cantabile playing, and something about the prelude just soothes my nerves. So I just thought it would be a perfect piece to start the entire program. And then the E minor prelude and fugue is more almost like improvised feeling. And then it concludes with a more excited and fast fugue.
Right.
And then the second piece I will be playing is Mozart's fourth piano sonata in E-flat major. So it's kind of like we're going from E major, E minor, and then going to E-flat major. not intentional, but yeah, I really like this sonata because I think it's the only one sonata that Mozart wrote that actually starts with a slow movement. And because Mozart's love towards operas, it just reminded me so much of like an aria, especially this movement. It's got this left-hand accompaniment that almost sounds like the string section from an orchestra, and then the right-hand melody just carries away in this super gorgeous singing style. And then followed by a minuet in the second movement, then the third movement is a rondo. And then the third piece on the program is Rachmaninoff's Etude in D minor, Opus 33, number 4. Basically, I chose these pieces for my program next Sunday is because I'm looking to do some auditions overseas. So I thought it would be a perfect opportunity to like list out all of the things that I will use for my audition to just get them to a performance standard.
Right,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's the Etude. That's why there's an Etude in the concert program. But yeah, it's also very beautiful and singing style, but very different from the previous Mozart. Mozart would more sound like just a classical operatic aria or something, but the Rachmaninoff, it's a different atmosphere. It's more, I would like to think of it as more misty and then slightly more mysterious.
A bit moody.
Yeah, a bit more moody.
Mm-hmm.
And it just reveals all of the colors that Rachmaninoff usually put into his compositions and just so many changing harmonies, and it's just very lush, and I like playing that as well. And then the final piece in the first half of the program will be Jetatura by our New Zealand composer John Sathis. The background of this composition was that there was a time that Sathis, he noticed some unexpected accidents that kept happening to his family members. Jessitura is the ancient belief that the gaze of strangers cast unwanted magic into the lives of the innocent. When they took a trip to Greece, they saw maybe you could call it witch or just fortune teller person. And then they said the blue glass eye is actually a talisman that keeps those unwanted gaze away. Fassus composed this piece, Jessitura, as the lucky talisman for his family to cast away the bad luck. Yeah. I learned this piece about 2 years ago, and back then I was just starting my second year, and it was quite a challenging piece for me to learn because there are so many detailed writing on rhythms, as well as unexpected accents, and the very thick and dense texture in the exposition and the recapitulation are just super, super, maybe I'll use the word bombastic, but super, super groundbreaking, let's say. It just explored the entire range of the piano keys from the very low A to the very top C. Yeah, it's a really, really challenging piece, but knowing the background story about it, it helped me to understand this composition more. As now I'm picking it up again, I can really just enjoy it a lot more.
After the interval, what? Because you've got a major piece then for the second part of the program by lots of things.
So for the second half, there will just be this one work by Liszt. It's the Sonata in B minor. This very standalone piece, and it's just extraordinary how Liszt used five simple motifs and then made them into this big, complicated work. Yeah, this is my main focus of this year, other than the concerto that I did earlier this year. I haven't had this piece for that long. I think I came back to it after just mildly learning the notes in February. Then I took some time away from it and then got back to it in August. The piece, it's really technically challenging as well as just very romantic and has lots of textures and layers that I just constantly have to remind myself, oh, what should I bring out here and what should I think of when I play a specific section? It's quite exciting, but it's just so physically demanding that I'm usually very, very exhausted by the end of it. And I have to think about reserving energy so that I have enough strength to play the final coda that is just a million octaves in both hands, playing at this prestissimo tempo, and it's just really, really crazy. It is a half an hour long piece. Sometimes people would find it difficult to focus and sit through the entire work. So I think my main goal for the next week is to just keep exploring with the storytelling and then perhaps record myself and listen back to how I'm currently playing so that I could make more changes to it that will make it sound more appealing to the audience.
Sounds quite dramatic. Dramatic one to finish with. Now, there's also a pre-concert talk from Kim Cuneo from the New Zealand School of Music. Do you know what Kim will be covering in his pre-concert talk?
Actually, I haven't talked to him about this yet. I know that throughout this year, Kim has been actively engaging the NZSM Orchestra and our students with some other orchestras in Wellington, like NZSO and Orchestra Wellington. So I think Kim would maybe mention about some of his plans for the music school in the future years and maybe some exciting news.
How far through your studies at the New Zealand School of Music are you?
I'm currently in my fourth year, so I'm doing Bachelor of Music with Honours. So it's essentially my last year. However, next year in the first trimester, I will come back and then finish this one last research paper, and then I will be done with my study here.
When did all your musical interest start? Because I believe it started at a very early age.
I started playing the piano when I was 4. We just kind of had weekly lessons and then did exams every year. But then by the time I was around 13, we decided to take a break from the piano. My family didn't have regular lessons planned for me anymore. But I think it was during that time from when I was 13 up until 17, so like around 3 or 4 years of gap. Although without any lessons, I still continuously practiced in my own time. And then that got to a point where I started to reflect on myself. I asked myself, why do I keep coming back to the piano? You know, and when I no longer have to do exams, I could just do whatever I want, but I just want to keep playing. And that was from that moment I thought, oh, maybe I should, you know, consider playing piano and pursue it as a career. And then I was in Christchurch during that time. So I found a really lovely teacher through my school. And then we started to have more lessons to get me, you know, back on track after 3-4 years of playing without any instructions. And I sort of just played whatever I want and gained a lot of bad habits. As I was older, it was easier for me to appreciate the logic and the beauty behind the music instead of just, you know, learning notes for each piece and then try to play it memorized. Practicing is a very, very long and endless, sometimes exhausting and boring thing to do, but I think most of the time I'm enjoying my practice sessions, even though it's, you know, it can be very, very tough to get used to, but that's something that I've grown to like, enjoy the practice sessions. And then I was in my third year of high school, so my senior year, when my teacher sort of suggested, oh, would you want to look at some potential universities that you could audition to? And then I looked at here, New Zealand School of Music in Wellington, and also Auckland University. But yeah, eventually I decided to come here because I listened to my current teacher, Jian Liu. He performed a recital in Christchurch. I think that was his tour called Nocturnes, where he played like 20 or 30 nocturnes by different composers. And I was just so stunned by his execution and like details and all the techniques, just everything. And then I was like, oh, I really want to learn with this teacher. And that's what motivated me to be more disciplined in fixing my technique and exploring more interpretations in music. And then, yeah, I successfully got into here. So that's that's what brought me here to study
for 4 years.
Yeah.
Well, what is your typical rehearsal practice schedule looking like at the moment? How much time do you spend?
I try to get 4 to 6 hours of practice just on my solo repertoire every day. So I would usually start with something slow like Bach or more classical like Mozart to just get my mind settled into the practice mood. And then after maybe 1 or 2 hours, I would be physically warmed up as well, so then I could start to conquer some of the more challenging pieces. Out of the 4 to 6 hours of solo, I also do around 2 to 3 hours of just collaborative practice. For example, the pieces that I'm working with others, I need to practice those, or including some rehearsal hours that I will be actually working with them. So
So yeah, that's about 8 hours per day.
That's a full-time job by anyone's estimate, isn't it?
Yeah. And because I currently don't have a piano at home, because my family, we just moved from Christchurch to Wellington almost 2 years ago. And because I'm looking at doing overseas studies for my master's degree, so we just thought, oh, we don't have to get a piano right now, because when I go overseas, it will just be sitting at home catching dust. So wow. I don't have a piano at home at the moment. That just makes me having to come into uni and practice every day. Basically, not 24/7, but something close to that.
I understand you're based in the Hutt Valley. Is that the case?
I live in Belmont, yes. Yeah, I just have to come to Kelburn campus to practice every day.
Right, sure. So have you had time to take part in any other sort of Hutt activities, sports or church groups or anything like that outside of music?
Not really.
No.
just because there's not enough time for me outside of music. I sort of just devoted myself entirely to what I'm doing right now. But I keep myself active in attending concerts. Like, I love watching ballet, opera, and then Orchestra Wellington and Insidesso concerts. Yeah, so that's pretty much my daily life every day. Practice, and then maybe go to concert, and then do more practice, rehearse, and then go home.
So you've just done a piano festival in Spain in August, I believe. What did that involve?
So that was a two-week-long program that consists of masterclasses, lessons, as well as some concerts that were happening during the festival. Oh, and also student recitals. So it's pretty much like a summer school, considering August is sort of like the summer break for the Northern Hemisphere. And during that festival, I was able to have 5 lessons with different professors. They all came from really prestigious schools from the North America region. So quite a lot of really good teachers, and I had lessons with 5 of them, attended loads of masterclass and met so many interesting students around the world. Since we're in New Zealand, it's really easy to just sit in the practice room and then not realizing what's happening in the rest of the world in the music industry.
Yeah.
But throughout this experience, I met so many students from the Northern Hemisphere, and they're all like, yeah, pretty much just like us, all stuck in the practice room every day. But I just experienced this wonderful feeling when you see someone and then you realize they're sort of like just like you. They don't do much in their daily life, but everyone is just working so hard to try and make better music. Everything that we talked about were just, what inspires us and what pieces we're currently working on. So it's pretty much like a really nerdy piano camp, but that's what we love to do and talk about. So I enjoyed that a lot. One of my other reasons for going to this festival was to explore some of the possible places that I could audition to during my audition application that's due in 2 months.
Right.
Yeah, I'm currently looking at maybe Canada or Europe, because the tuition fees are slightly more friendly in those places. And probably I'll also look at the UK as well. And yeah, I also had a look at some of the schools in America, but they have wonderful, wonderful teachers, but I don't really have the confidence to be able to get full scholarship. So
right.
I will still give them a shot, but it's the tuition fees that's quite expensive. So that's what's stopping me from possibly going there. Yeah.
How long away would a master's study involve? How long a period?
Usually, if studying full-time, master's will be 2 years.
Right.
Yeah, and my plan is to start from here and then audition to a master's program overseas. And then from there, once I'm close to finish, I could apply for perhaps like a doctoral degree and then come back to New Zealand. That's my current plan, but maybe it will change.
And you've been very busy at the moment too. I think you've been doing some work with the New Zealand Symphony Orchestra and the School of Music Orchestra pieces quite recently as well.
Yes, that was last month in September. Earlier this year, I won the New Zealand School of Music concerto competition, and I played the first concerto by Sergei Rachmaninoff. So it's this very, very exciting, beautiful, and just so gorgeous piece. And as the prize of winning the competition, I get to play with our international orchestra in the final concert as a soloist. And then I think Kim reached out to NZSO saying it would be good to do some collaboration. And then I played with both orchestras in the same session at the Michael Feller Center. It was an hour and a half of just purely rehearsing on the Rachmaninoff and then gaining some ideas and experience with Maestro James Judd.
What did you take away from that? What did you learn from your James Judd in NZSO experience?
I remember I was very, very nervous, but it was quite magical, like sitting there in front of this big, like twice the size of our own, no, maybe three times the size of our own international orchestra. Everyone were just so, so lovely and so supportive. Like they would never look at you in a judging way if I played a wrong note or something, or I missed my entry. Yeah, it was, again, this unity in the music that, you know, we all came from different places. Some of us just started in their first year in our orchestra, and then there's people from the NZSO that's in their 60s, 70s, or maybe even older. Yeah, everyone is just doing their best to make the music come alive. Conductor James Judd, he was also very, very nice and supportive. He just kept telling me, it's okay, just try to relax and then just bring emotions to the music and enjoy the process. And my teacher, Jian, he was also there to listen. And then, yeah, he I think him being there sort of just settled me down a little bit, because usually when I get nervous, I tend to rush a lot. And he just told me, if anything happens, just try to listen more to the orchestra and then let them carry the tempo. And then I'm sort of just almost playing chamber music with them instead of thinking, oh, I'm the soloist and everyone needs to listen to me. It should be more like an exchange of idea. And then everyone in the most ideal way should be almost breathing together and then, yeah, just making one music.
Right. The best place to follow your work, where, Amelia, would that be?
I do have a YouTube channel. Throughout the past couple of years, I've uploaded some videos of my playing, recordings from my exams. Actually, I've got some recordings from when I performed in Upper Hutt Expressions in Lunchtime Concert Series as well, and also the concerto performance last month that I had with the NZSM Orchestra. But yeah, mainly YouTube.
YouTube, and it's called Amelioration. I like that.
Oh, yeah, that's that one.
The power of Google. The power of Google.
Oh, wow, yes.
That is brilliant. Okay, finally then, your message to Hutt Zone radio listeners on coming along to the concert on the 26th of October to Whirinaki Expressions. What would those words of encouragement be?
Yeah, I think my biggest motivation is to bring and share the music that I love to people. Although I know on the program, the Liszt V minor sonata would seem a bit intimidating because some people would think, oh, there's no way I would know how to interpret that. But I hope people could just come along and then join me in a lovely Sunday afternoon and listen to some music that I really appreciate and enjoy playing, and hope they could have a wonderful time watching me play the performance. I hope people enjoy.
And that was Amelia Lynn, who plays at Whirinaki Expressions in Upper Hutt this Sunday, 2 p.m. Tickets available from iTickets or from Whirinaki Whare Taonga. Also on this long weekend is the annual Wellington Folk Festival at Brookfield Outdoor Education Centre, Moores Valley, Wainuiomata. It kicks off at noon tomorrow through to Sunday night. It includes folk performances, workshops, music and dance. It's the 60th anniversary. You can get tickets online or at the gate. You can be either for the entire weekend or can just pop in for the day or evening. And their website for more information is wellingtonfolkfestival.org.nz. But that means it's the end of this week's show. Thanks to all my guests tonight, and a big thank you to you for listening to the show and supporting Wellington Access Radio. You can always listen again to the show as a podcast on the Hutt's Own pages of accessradio.org.nz. If you have a suggestion of a Hutt story or a piece of musical poetry, then please do message us either on Facebook, John McDonald NZ, or email the team. And our email is thehutzone@outlook.co.nz. Let's go out with Kumbaya Blazira's Game We Should Have Won. Until next Thursday, mate wa e noho oru mai ra. Stay well.
Score a penalty, I'm channeling the spirit of Lionel Messi and the spirit of Bruce Lee. I know he's watching over me, I'm a man with the king and the guy from Zimati. Someone there is dawning a warning, a work in the morning, I ain't worth throwing yawning. I said, well, wait, you do like replay the game 100 times in my head. And do we want it, I believe in the spread.
We should have won, we should have won, we should have won. Oh, it's the game I should have won.
Running
through my head,
running through my head,
running through my head.
What's the game I should have won?
Through my head,
running through my head,
running through my head.
What's the game I should have won?
That program was brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard. Thanks New Zealand On Air for funding accessmedia.nz.